Ativartate.
Ativartate.
Yaksamupatitam deha.
Yaksamupatitam deha.
Akashan manyum ulbanam.
Akashan
manyum ulbanam. Atmajigyasya yachet.
Atmajigyasya yachet.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Saguna nativartate.
Saguna nativartate.
Yaksamo patitam deha.
Yaksamo patitam deha.
Akashan manyumulbanam.
Akashan manyumulbanam.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Saguna nativartate.
Saguna nativartate.
Yaksamutpatitam deha.
Yaksamutpatitam deha.
Akashan manyumulbanam.
Akashan manyumulbanam.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Atma jigyasaya yachet.
Saguna nativartate.
Saguna nativartate.
Yaha.
Yaha.
Anyone who?
Anyone who?
Samutpatitam.
Samutpatitam.
Suddenly awakened.
Suddenly awakened.
Dehe.
Dehe.
In the body.
In the body.
Akashat,
akashat,
from the sky,
from the sky.
Manyum,
manyum,
anger,
anger.
Ulbanam,
ulbanam,
powerful,
powerful.
Atmajigyasaya,
atmajigyasaya,
by inquiry into spiritual realization,
by inquiry into spiritual realization,
or self realization,
or self realization.
Yache,
yache.
Subdues.
Saha.
That person.
Person.
Gunan.
The modes of material nature.
Ativartate.
Transcends.
Transcends. Translation. One who inquires into self-realization and thus subdues his powerful anger, which awakens suddenly in the body as if falling from the sky, transcends the influence of the modes of material nature. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada Ki. When one becomes angry, he forgets himself and his situation. But if one is able to consider his situation by knowledge, one transcends the influence of the modes of material nature. One is always a servant of lusty desires, anger, greed, illusion, envy, and so on and so forth. But if one obtains sufficient strength and spiritual advancement, one can control them. One who obtains such control will always be transcendentally situated, untouched by the modes of material nature. This is only possible when one fully engages in the service of the Lord. As the Lord Himself says in Bhagavad Gita, Mam chayovya bicharina bhakti yogina sevate sakunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the spiritual platform. By engaging one in devotional service, the Krishna consciousness movement keeps one always transcendental to anger, greed, lust, envy, and so forth. One must perform devotional service because otherwise one will become victimized by the modes of material nature. Srila Prabhupada ki. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschadade Shatavine Vanchakau Patarudescha Kripa Sindhu Devacha Patitanam Bhavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namah Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
Fourteen of the fourth chapter of the sixth canto.
Yah samut patitam deha akashan manyum ulbanam atma jigyasaya yachet sagunan ativartate.
So here the anger which is manifested by prachetas and which is the main problem being dealt in this series of verses by Soma preaching to prachetas to stop manifesting their anger which they accumulated due to their austerities is compared with the lightning bolt. All of a sudden from the sky the lightning bolt comes. In a similar way, the emotion of anger or any other strong emotion, ulbanam, ulbanam, very strong, sometimes comes and totally overpowers us, totally overpower our intelligence. And we cannot do anything about it. Emotions are sometimes so strong that really there is nothing we can do to control them. But still, there is a hope. And here, the word yachet is used in a sense of ordering. You have to do it. Atma jigyasya yachet sagunana ativartate. You can transcend the state of being a slave of your emotions. You can totally, completely subdue your emotions. Moreover, you have to do it. Yachet. Yachet means you have to do it. How? Atma jigyasya. Through the inquiry about the nature of yourself. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, translates this as self-realization. And he quotes the famous verse from Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna recommends the same using Bhakti Yoga in the instrumental case. Sagunan samatityatam Bhakti Yogena sevate Mamchayo vyabicharina Bhakti Yogena sevate Bhakti Yogena. In this particular verse at the end of the 14th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which deals with the problem of the modes of material nature enslaving us in this material world, Bhagavad Gita is using, and Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is using the word Bhakti Yoga in instrumental case, which means that we use Bhakti Yoga as the means, as the method, as the instrument in our hands to subdue the modes of material nature. We know that Bhakti Yoga is the goal. Bhakti is the goal. But at the same time, from the very beginning, Bhakti is the means. And that's the glory. And that's actually the proof that Bhakti Yoga is totally transcendental. Because usually, and this is a deep philosophical point which I have no time to elaborate on, but please believe me, in philosophy it is said that when there is a duality between the means and the goal, then the method is second class. But when the goal and the means are the same, there is no duality, then it's totally transcendental.
In material processes, we have this difference. The goal is one, and the means is different from the goal. But the proof that the most powerful process of bhakti yoga is totally transcendental is that in a stage of sadhana, it serves as a means. And on the stage, of sadhya, it serves as the goal. this is a very important thing, and now we have to really see how to use bhakti yoga as the means. How is bhakti yoga as the means? What happens? And Srila Prabhupada explains it partially in the purport to this verse. And His Holiness Sachinanda Maharaj asked me to speak a little bit about the verse, about the lecture which I spoke in Heidelberg. So I will combine these two. He wanted me to speak on the topic of hermeneutics, which is a very high word. I don't know if I will be able to speak on this topic, but I will try to speak a little bit in this regard, because it's very important to see how, in connection with this particular topic, because it's very important for us to see and to understand how to use bhakti yoga as an instrument, how it works, how we are using the method of bhakti yoga to subdue all these problems, starting with kama, krodha, loba, mada, moha, and matsarya are the six enemies which we have within our heart, and the six enemies are the product of material nature, of our conditioning within material nature. So there is of course a very famous verse which is used by Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, also describing this. Kamadina katina katida palita durnidesham tesham jatamai na karuna na trapa na pashantih utsrijayata matha yadupate sampraptam labdha buddhis. What is the last line? Utsrijayata matha yadupate sampraptam labdha buddhis mamayatam. Tvam. Tvamayatam saranam abhayam mam dasya viyunksatve dasya, or something like this. Anyway, so in this verse, which is the expression of lamentation, the devotee says, kamadina katina katida palita durnidesham, I have been a servant of my karma, of my lust, of my anger, of my greed, of my illusion, of my pride, of my envy, for so long. And I have been obediently fulfilling their ridiculous orders. Durnidesham. Durnidesham means they would order me and I would obediently fulfill all their orders. And he's lamenting like this. Kamadina katina patita napalita nakatida palita durnidesham. Tesham jatamai nakaruna na trapa na pasanti. But despite of my being such an obedient servant, I've been doing this, I've been serving them life after life after life, but despite this, they have no mercy upon me. Because the masters are supposed to be, if they're ordering and I'm so obediently doing, they can give me some mercy, some reward, but no mercy, na karuna, na trapa, no shame, no pasanti, and they don't leave me alone. Despite of me so obediently following their orders, I'm still completely harassed by all these problems. And then this devotee, by explaining this, he's saying, what should happen next? Utsrijayatam atha yadupate sarpraptam labdha buddhis. But now my intelligence has awakened. Because my intelligence, sampraptam labdha buddhis, because my intelligence has awakened, then I will be able to get the strength to relinquish them, to reject them. Utsrijayata matha. Because I have now approached you, O Yadapati. Yadupati means the master of the family of the Yadus. Krishna, in his form of Dvarakadish, who is the protector of Dharma. So, because I understand that there is a God who is protector of Dharma, my intelligence has awakened. And then I can ayatam saranam abhayam, tvam ayatam saranam abhayam. Please engage me in your devotional service. So here also Prabhupada, he explains this. He says that by engaging in devotional service, we obtain the strength to conquer over all these problems. And the strength is coming from buddhi, from intelligence. Labdha buddhis. By understanding that there is God and by serving God, the main thing which should happen within our heart is this amazing process of obtaining the proper, strong buddhi or intelligence. Sampraptam labdha buddhis. So this is basically the process. The process of devotional service is the process of developing or evolving our buddhi, our intelligence. And we should never neglect this or underestimate this process of evolution. That the devotional service is not a blind faith, as Prabhupada said. It's not just a bunch of strange rituals. It's a very powerful process of developing buddhi, the intelligence. And I would venture in a very dangerous area trying to explain this, and then I will come to the subject matter of hermeneutics. Trying to explain this process of conquering over these problems by the intelligence obtained through the means of devotional service by using the example of the six demons killed by Krishna subsequently. Jaya and Vijaya, we know, were born subsequently as three pairs of demons, which were, of course, killed by Krishna. I believe it's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. I heard it, I didn't read it, but I heard it from Sivaram Maharaj. But Sivaram Maharaj is usually very particular when it comes to this kind of stuff. That these six demons represent six anarthas, or six enemies within our heart, mentioned by Srila Prabhupada in this purport. And these six demons, usually kama is the generic term. Kama, like in this previous verse which I quoted, kamadina, kama adi, started with kama. And usually it all starts with kama. Kama, krodha, loba, moha, mada, and matsari. In this particular order, they're being represented. Kama means lust. And we know that kama is the most difficult. But again, it's used in generic term because the kama is more or less the representation of everything else. It starts with kama, with lust, but then anger naturally develops. The development of this is very natural. Kama, lust for sense enjoyment, brings about anger if it's not fulfilled. I want something, and if something is not being fulfilled as I want, I become angry. That's the only reason why I become angry. Then, if kama is fulfilled, this is again is explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Gita commentaries. If kama is fulfilled, then it creates what? My kama is fulfilled, it creates what? Greed. No, greed. I want more. Because it's a very big illusion in this world that we think that if my desires or lust is fulfilled, then I'm done with it. No, you're not done with it. You want more and more and more. Some people think, I need only $1 million. And if I have $1 million, that's enough. But the problem is that when you have $1 million, you will want to have $10 million. And when you have $10 million, you will have to
have $100 million, and when you have $100 million, it's never enough. You know, I know one man who is a multimillionaire, who has at least $2 billion, and he's still not satisfied. He's just, you know, he doesn't know what to do with this money. Absolutely no way to deal with this. But you know, how possibly you can spend all this money or use it for some gratification? You know, but still he's just running like mad with eyes big like this. He wants more and more and more and more. So the greed is being developed when the karma is fulfilled. So there is it's no win solution. If karma is not fulfilled, you become angry. If karma is fulfilled, you become greedy. And then because of this greed and anger, both greed and anger, and they totally, completely bewilder you. Greed and anger produce moha. Moha means you don't really know what you're doing anymore. This is coming from the Sanskrit root muhyati. Muh means totally bewildered. There is in Russian language, the word fly sounds muha. And I was thinking that probably it has very deep Sanskrit connection. Because when you see the fly, muha, when the the fly is flying, it's totally bewildered. You know, when you look at the fly, in the beginning it seems that it's very determined. It flies here and there and there and there, you know, as if it has some goal, but ultimately just totally in complete state of confusion. So, muhyati or moha means you are bewildered because you don't know what to do because of this greed and anger, because of all this emotions which are very strong within your consciousness. And then, of course, because you are generally bewildered, because you are so bewildered, because you completely forgot about your real scale of your existence, you become very proud. I'm big. Of course, you're very big. You're very big microbe. You become very, very puffed up. And then it is also explained by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that the combination of these five, that the cocktail, the shake of these five, the very refined mixture of these five problems create envy, matsari, create the main problem of our existence when we become really angry. But of course we know that these six demons which are described on the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam represent these six particular problems. Hiranyaksha, his very name implies greed. Hiranyaksha means his aksha, his eyes are gold. And it means, another meaning is that the gold is always in his eyes. Wherever he looks, he sees gold. Hiranyaksha means greed. You know, I want gold. I want the greed. And we know that in this particular story of Hiranyaksha, we see how the greed is the root cause or is the cause of the degradation of the whole earth. The greed, greed for sense gratification, greed for, greed to enjoy, which is, of course, in modern society, very politely is called consumerism. You know, it's a very big word in modern society. You just consume, consume and consume more and more. This is represented by glorious Hiranyaksha, who is big up to the sky and who is pushing the earth down. The earth is being degraded into the mud of the Garbhodaka ocean by this quality of greed.
So Hiranyaksha is representing greed, and Hiranyakashipu is of course the representation of pride. He is the pride personified. He is the, you know, nobody is as powerful as him. And he is so proud that he says that, you know, even Krishna is afraid of me. He is hiding from me. Vishnu is hiding where? In the heart. In the heart of Hiranyakashipu. Because that's the only place where he is not looking in. You know? This is the only place which is which he is not really interested in. To see what is there within his heart. So Vishnu is hiding them. And this is the pride personified. And then we have Kumbhakarna, who is the next demon, the elder brother of Ravana. And, you know, of course, Kumbhakarna is... What is he doing? He's sleeping. And not only sleeping, he is dreaming. Because when he asked for this benediction, the goddess of speech, you know, entered his mouth, and she pushed him to say that he wants swapna. He wanted power and he wanted immortality, but instead he asked for swapna, for the sleep. And he's sleeping and dreaming. Very rarely he wakes up, makes some nonsense, and then sleeps again. And this is moha, illusion. The representation of moha is very vividly described in the demon of Kumbhakarna. And then, of course, Ravana. And Ravana, the name Ravana means roaring. He's just yelling and crying and roaring. Who is roaring within our heart? Yeah. Who? No. Lust. Lust is roaring within our heart. The lust. I want, I want, I want, I want. This very loud demon within our heart. You know, he's the louder, you know, because I want, this is the loudest voice which we hear always within our mind, within our consciousness. I want, I want, I want, I want. So this Ravana is a representation of lust, which is the most difficult problem which we have to deal with. Therefore, it starts from the lust. But still we see in this progression of demonic qualities, lust is not the first. So this is the dangerous thing which I want to tell about. And then we have Shishupal. Shishupal is the next who is killed by Krishna. In the next incarnation, we have Shishupal, who is the envy personified. He's so envious. He's so envious of Krishna that he has only faults in Krishna. He was given a benediction that he can find 101 fault in Krishna. 100, you know. And he's there and he's fuming and he's saying, you're bad this and that, and you are just a cowherd, and you're a coward, and you're this and that. And so many faults are there. And Krishna is smiling there. And he's counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Because he promised to his aunt that he will not kill this demon before he transgressed the limit of 100 faults found in him. And this is envy. Because ultimately our envy is the envy against God. And then the last problem is anger. Dantavakra. Srila Prabhupada describes in Krishna book that when Dantavakra wanted to fight with Krishna, he was so angry that he didn't have any weapon besides his anger. His anger was red hot. Of course, he had a club in his head. But his main weapon was anger. So, the sequence in this particular case is very important as in Vedic literature. And we can see that if we analyze these problems of our heart in this particular sequence, we will see that this is the sequence in which these problems will be eradicated from our heart. If we really try to think about the message of the Vedas, then we have to also and to use our intelligence to understand and to clear our consciousness, then we can actually derive a lot of benefit. Again, Krishna is calling or is naming Bhakti Yoga as Buddhi Yoga in Bhagavad Gita, and he is saying that through your Buddhi, through your intelligence, you can connect with me. And it's a very important thing also to use the intelligence properly, to use the intelligence in the service of the Lord. So first I will come to this topic of hermeneutics a little bit, about this symbolic meanings of the Vedas, how we should use the intelligence by interpreting Vedas in a particular way. We know from the Sanskrit grammar and from the Sanskrit descriptions that each and every word in Sanskrit has many meanings. This is the beauty of Sanskrit, and this is actually it has a double meaning. It can give you a lot of insight, and it can bewilder you as well. But there are four general usages of the word, which is called vritti. Vritti means function. There is this mukhya vritti, or actually three, or actually two. There is mukhya vritti, which is the literal meaning of the Sanskrit word, and there is lakshana vritti, which is the indirect meaning of Sanskrit word, or indirect function of Sanskrit word. And the mukhya vritti is divided into two functions. This is rudi, which is conventional meaning, and yoga vritti. Yoga vritti means the meaning of the words through derivation, through the root, through the verbal root from which the word is being derived. Like, for example, the word Krishna. The literal meaning of Krishna is what? What is the literal meaning of word Krishna? No. This is literal meaning too. But the conventional meaning of word Krishna is God, right? Who is Krishna? God. You know, if you say Krishna, then conventional meaning, the immediate meaning which has in our consciousness or in consciousness of anyone who is somewhat familiar with Vedic literature, Krishna means God. So this is rudhi vritti. And then yoga vritti, it's all attractive. Because the word Krishna comes from the verbal root krish, and krish means to pull, krish means to attract. So Krishna, the one who gives attraction, one who is attracting everyone, who is pulling everyone, the center of attraction. So this is, again, this is mukhya vritti, the literal meaning, but mukhya vritti has these two divisions. By using or analyzing the words of Sanskrit language, of the words of the scriptures, even in those two main meanings, we can derive a lot of meaning, deeper meaning from the words of the scriptures. We have to really see, and sometimes we see how acharyas push us to think. Actually, when we see and when we read the commentaries of the acharyas of Srila Prabhupada, the commentaries are there to teach us how to think. Because, you know, if a scholar reads this kind of commentary, for the scholar it's not scholarly. For the scholar, the commentaries of Srila Prabhupada, he will make a case that, you know, commentaries, if you know something, you just put little footnote here. This is what usually scholars understand when they need to comment something. You know, you give some valuable information connecting with this particular passage or whatever. But Srila Prabhupada, in his commentaries, what he does, he teaches us how to think about the meanings, how to really derive the deeper essence of what is there in the verse. And this is what we have to learn by reading. Learn how to sing, how to really derive deeper meaning. So this mukhya vritti, or direct meaning, has these two aspects. And the lakshana vritti, again, has two aspects. The indirect meaning of Sanskrit word has lakshana vritti, proper, and gauna vritti. These two functions of the indirect meaning. And lakshana vritti means related meaning. In the Sanskrit word, like for example, the famous example of lakshana vritti is Gangayam Gosham. Gangayam Gosham means the village of the cowherds on Ganga. Gangayam Gosham, in Ganga. But because there cannot be village in the Ganga, village doesn't float on the Ganga River. So the meaning here is that village on the bank of Ganga, because the bank is closely related to Ganga. Therefore, instead of saying bank of Ganga, you say Ganga, and it means bank of Ganga. In other words, you may say something and mean at the same time something which is closely related to this, which is close by. So this is lakshana vritti, and gauna vritti, metaphorical meaning. When you say something metaphorically, this is also again related, but related in a symbolical sense. And therefore, when, for example, our acharyas are very strict in this sense, because this is again the rule of Sanskrit poetry, that first you have to understand the mukhya vritti. The mukhya vritti is most important, and first, by interpreting some text, you have to take the literal meaning first. And you should not really venture into this gauna vritti, lakshana vritti, because this is the way of being bewildered. We can see that when Vallabhacharya came to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he came to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in a very humble mood, and he said, I found the new meaning of the word Krishna. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he became angry. He said, I don't want to hear this new meaning of word Krishna. Only thing which I know, that Krishna is God, Ishvara, and Krishna is Yashoda Nandana. He is the son of Mother Yashoda. This is the only two meaning about Krishna which I want to know and I need to know. I don't need to know anything else. I don't need to know any other speculated meaning of this word Krishna. And he actually quotes, I believe, Amar Kosa dictionary or classical dictionary, which gives this literally meaning of words. And the literally meaning of word Krishna is this too. You know, he is Yashoda Nandana, he is the little boy, blue in color, who sits on the laps of Mother Yashoda. That's conventional meaning. Of course, he's God, and this is also literal meaning of the word Krishna. So, and we know how Srila Prabhupada was angry when somebody was trying to interpret Bhagavad Gita in this symbolic means. When somebody was saying, you know, Bhagavad Gita means, you know, Krishna means mind, and Pandavas means five senses, and Kurukshetra means the heart. And in the heart, the five senses with Krishna are fighting with Duryodhana. And Duryodhana is all the vices which are there. And this is all the meaning of Bhagavad Gita. And Prabhupada would become very angry. He would say, this is ridiculous, this is nonsense. Kurukshetra is not the heart, Kurukshetra is there. It's north of Delhi. How you say that this is the heart if there is Kurukshetra? And in Kurukshetra, Krishna was there. Because by trying to interpret in this symbolic way, you are basically trying to reduce Krishna to symbol. You're saying that there is no God, you know, it's just something really nice and symbolical, and you just do this speculation. You know, and the people who do this, Mayavadis who usually do this, they're becoming bewildered. Why this way of interpreting Vedic scriptures is so dangerous is that ultimately the end result is that you get bewildered. You know, I had a personal experience of this. I was once on a train in India,
And one man was sitting in front of me. He looked very intelligent, and he was smoking all the time. And I was reading Bhagavad Gita, and he looked at my book, and he said, "Oh, you're reading Bhagavad Gita?" He said, "Yes, I'm reading Bhagavad Gita." And he asked me, "Do you want to know the meaning of Bhagavad Gita?" And he was smoking. I said, "No, I don't want to know the meaning of Bhagavad Gita from you. Thank you very much." He said, no, I will now explain to you the meaning, because you're probably bewildered. And I will now reveal this meaning to you." And he was still smoking. I said, "My dear sir, if you know the meaning of Bhagavad Gita, why do you smoke?" He said, "This is not important. But please listen." And he started going into this. Krishna is the mind, Pandavas are the senses, Kurukshetra is the heart, and Abhimanyu is the kidney, and this and that, so many different things, you know. He said, "This is the real meaning." I said, "You know, if you know the meaning of Bhagavad Gita, why do you smoke?" And then he became silent for a moment. And then he said, "I'm not smoking. My body is smoking, and I'm in the soul. The soul is not smoking. This is just the body who is smoking. That's it." And I said, "Yeah, thank you very much. Now I know everything about Bhagavad Gita and the philosophy and Mayavada, and how you can be totally, completely bewildered by this way of interpreting Vedic scriptures." Because in this way you don't take anything seriously. In this way the whole meaning of Vedas becomes literally reduced to kind of game of words, game of symbols. But at the same time, we know that our acharyas also explain sometimes this symbolic meaning or metaphorical meaning. Like we know Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam that Sadgarbha Suras, that six sons of Mother Devaki represent this particular six vices within our heart: Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Mada, and Matsarya. And that these enemies have to be killed first before we can achieve Krishna within our heart. That first these six enemies are killed, and then Balarama is entering the heart or the womb of Mother Devaki, and the womb or heart of Mother Devaki is the womb of pure consciousness. And we know that Vasudev represents the pure consciousness, and this is the state of pure consciousness. We know how Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati also explained this. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati also very beautifully explains, gives the symbolic meaning. He says, "What is Yamuna?" He's explaining the land of Raja. What is land of Raja? He says the land of Raja is the land of pure consciousness. And Yamuna is the stream of pure consciousness, circumambulating this land of pure consciousness. And he says there, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he is explaining how these different demons in Vraja Lila represent different anarthas. So how shall we understand this? What is the use if we only should use the Mukhya Vritti? Why should we sometimes employ Lakshana Vritti or even Gauna Vritti in the interpretation? And what is it? So my humble answer to this is derived from Madhvacharya. Madhvacharya explains in his Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya, in his commentary to Mahabharata, that Mahabharata, he incorporated Mahabharata into his philosophy. Usually acharyas don't do this because Mahabharata is too big. And Mahabharata is too diversified. There are too many things in Mahabharata. But to prove, to employ Mahabharata as the praman for his philosophy of Dvaitavada, Shuddha Dvaitavada, Madhvacharya incorporated Mahabharata as well, and he wrote this book, Summary Study of Mahabharata, Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya. And in the beginning of this book, he says that Mahabharata is written in three languages, that there is not one language in which Mahabharata is written. It's not just Sanskrit. Because, you know, sometimes one can wonder what's the three languages. And he says there are three languages,
And these three languages in which Mahabharata is written, and each word in Mahabharata has to be translated from these three languages. He says there are these three languages is Darshana Bhasha, Guhya Bhasha, and Samadhi Bhasha. The three languages in which Mahabharata are written, first is Darshana Bhasha, and Darshana Bhasha is of course philosophical language. But at the same time, it's obvious language. Darshana, something which can be seen. Darshana Bhasha is the philosophical language of Mahabharata, but at the same time, that's an obvious language, or literal language. And then he says, but at the same time, in Mahabharata, there is something else is going on. In each and every verse of Mahabharata, it's written in three languages at the same time. Guhya Bhasha, which means confidential language, the language of secret. And then there is Samadhi Bhasha, the third language, which can be understood only by those persons whose intelligence is totally in Samadhi. At the same time, there is a deeper meaning in each and every episode of Mahabharata, in each and every verse of Mahabharata. And of course, Madhvacharya himself, he very boldly said that, he said that each and every word of Mahabharata has at least 10 meanings. And he said, and when you take Vishnu Sahasranam, each and every word of Vishnu Sahasranam has at least 100 meanings. And he has written a commentary on Vishnu Sahasranam where he explains 100 meanings of each and every word of Vishnu Sahasranam. So, this is again the way to teach us how to think about how to concentrate and how to absorb our mind in the scriptures. Because this is a very important process for us to understand the deeper and deeper meanings. And then he says, and Samadhi Bhasha, it's interesting what he wants to say while he is explaining the three languages. I think it was also Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. He explained what it means, three different languages. He used a very beautiful story from Indian history. I don't remember the name of the king, but there was one king in Assam. It's a historical episode. This king of Assam was a powerful king, but his kingdom was once conquered over by an enemy. And his capital was overtaken, and he ran away. But his wife was kept as a capture by the king who conquered over his kingdom. And she was kept as a prisoner. And the king who took over this kingdom, he wanted to kill the previous king. And he kept this wife and was torturing the wife just to push the king to come and to surrender to him. So, the king, he knew about this. The king who was in exile, he knew about this fate of his wife, and he was attached to his wife. So he dressed himself as an ascetic, as a sannyasi. He put this dress as a sannyasi, he put matted hairs, and he was very skinny, and nobody could recognize him. He entered the city, and he came to the palace of the king, and he said, "I'm the guru of the former king's wife. Can you please take me to the former king's wife? Who is kept as a prisoner." So they took him because he's a guru and maybe he will give her a good advice, because they were pushing her to tell, "Where is your husband? Tell us, where is your husband?" And he's coming in front of her. And you see this, you can understand immediately this meeting. She immediately recognizes him. Nobody else knows this is the king. And she knows he's crazy. What is he doing? He will be killed now. He will be, you know, he's there just in the palace of this king who wants to kill him. And she looks at him and they bring him closer to her, but she cannot say anything because it's in front of all her prisoners. He started saying to her, and he knows that she knows that he knows that's him, and he starts saying something to her, and he says something to her that, you know, why you are in this condition. He starts rebuking her, and he wants to say to her, why do you torture yourself? Just tell them, here I am, and let them kill me, and you'll be free. And she's saying, get away this pretender, he's a pretender, he's an imposter, he says he's my guru, I don't know him, he's not my guru, just drive him away. So there is kind of dialogue going on between them. And only they understand what is the real meaning of this dialogue. She knows he's saying this to her, although externally he's saying completely different things. He's saying this to her, you know, just, why do you do this to yourself? Just tell them where I am and that's it, you know, let them be happy. And she's saying, get out of here, I don't want to hear this, you know, please take care of yourself. But the meaning, the external meaning is completely different. Internal meaning is only known to these two persons. The external meaning is known to everyone. There is this literally meaning, but at the same, at the very same time, something completely different is going on in the same dialogue. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says, the same thing is going on in the Vedas. In the Vedas, you have to really develop and really to clarify your intelligence to the extent that you can see all these languages going on at the same time, Samadhi Bhasha. We know that the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is written in Samadhi Bhasha. Sometimes people, they wonder why the name Radha is not mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam. You know, why? Why, if Radha is so important in the theology of Krishna being God, why her name is not explicitly mentioned? Because it's written in Samadhi Bhasha. And if you are in a state of Samadhi, you will see the name of Radha 25 times on every page of Srimad Bhagavatam. You will see the name of Radha in every verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. If you are on this level, you just have to develop your intelligence. And this is extremely important point, this development of intelligence to understand the language. And then also Sripad Madhvacharya, he explains that the same Mahabharata story has three different meanings. And again, he is doing very interesting thing. He is taking from Mahabharata itself. In the beginning of Mahabharata, it is said that there is a verse in Mahabharata where Vyasadeva says that there is in this Mahabharata, in this book, there will be the story of Manu, Manvadi, something starting with Manu. And then he says that there will be also a story of different sages, started with the sage Astika. And then there will be, in this pages of Mahabharata, you will read the story of the kings, started with Uparicharu Vasu, the first king. And Madhvacharya takes this verse of Mahabharata, where there is this three lines of stories, and there is a very obvious literal meaning of this in Mahabharata, the story of Manu, the story of different kings, and the story of different sages, it's all there. But he says, what he means to say, Vyasadev, that there is three meanings of the whole Mahabharata story. He says that literally what is going on in Mahabharata has the three layers of meaning. One is Manvadi, and Manvadi means more or less the literal meaning of how the devotees and non-devotees are fighting with each other. This is one meaning. Another meaning, this Manvadi meaning, Manvadi Artha of Mahabharata. And then Astikadi meaning of Mahabharata, the next layer which you have to understand what is going on is how at the same time in Mahabharata it is being described how the vices and the virtues are fighting with each other. And that's, again, not the opinion of Sammayavadi, that's opinion of Madhvacharya, who is Acharya of our Sampradaya. He says, in the same Mahabharata story, you can see how the internal conflict is being described. The internal problem is being described, how the different virtues and vices are conflicting with each other, represented by different heroes of Mahabharata. Like he says that Arjuna represents, I think, determination, and Nakula and Sahadev represents this, and Yudhisthira represents the piety, and Bhima represents, you know, so many different virtues, because it's written by Madhvacharya, and he's very partial when it comes to Bhima, you know. He's extolling his glories very much. And then he says Duryodhana represents this, and this is at the same time it's going on in the same storyline. And then he says Uparicharu Vasu, meaning the third meaning of Mahabharata, is even more interesting. He says at the same time, when while reading Mahabharata, the story of Mahabharata, you have and that's another important layer of the meaning within Mahabharata itself, how Narayana, God, is acting within our lives, how he is actively involved in our life. And this is, he says, this is the third line of the, or the third layer of Mahabharata story. And here I'm totally bewildered, you, I understand this very clearly. But the point here is that, again, we have to learn when should I stop? Because I still have...
Please finish your subject, and do you have enough time?
Yes. Because I don't want to torture you, but at the same time, I want to... Anyway, please bear with me. I just want to tell you a few more things which I think is important. The whole thing is explained in the beginning of the 87th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. How this works, and maybe Maharaj, it will also be of some use for your seminar.
Mm-hmm.
Because there, in the very first verse of this chapter, which is the prayers of personified Vedas. Again, the point which I will try to explain now is that why should we think so deeply about the scriptures? It is the command of Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Gargi, oh no, Yajnavalkya is saying to his wife Maitreya, Atmavare Drashtavyam. He says, Atmavare Drashtavyam, you have to see the Lord. Drashtavyam means you have to see him by your own eyes. And then he says, how you can see the Lord? For that, Shrotavya, Mantavyo, Nididhyasitavyo. In order to see the Lord, you have to hear, then to sing, and then Nididhyasitavyo. Then you will come to the stage of Nididhyasa, which means the complete absorption or meditation on the Lord. And then through this meditation you will be able to see. So there is a gradual progression. First you have to hear, then you have to sing. Sing very deeply. Then this deep thinking will turn you into this Nididhyasa, the state of meditation, total, complete meditation on the Lord, and then you will see Him. This is how the buddhi or intelligence should work. First you hear, then you think, then you meditate, and then ultimately you come to the stage of seeing the Lord face to face. And it is being explained by Shukadeva Goswami in a very interesting way. Should I really say
yes,
this?
Yes, you must hear.
Because it's a little complicated. And
no, anyway. We can follow very easily. We are in the best.
So, Sukadev Goswami, this 87th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam starts with the question of Maharaja Pariksit. And Maharaja Pariksit is asking, on behalf of the sages, who are sitting there, he's asking Sukadev Goswami, how really the words of the Vedas can really describe Krishna? How really you can understand Krishna by the words which are totally material? The material sounds, the material meaning is there, the material connotation are there in our mind, and when we hear all these descriptions of Krishna, you know, of Krishna tending cows and of Krishna of playing flute, you know, how you can understand that this is Brahman? How you can really reach Brahman or understand the spiritual philosophy through all these descriptions, which are there in the Vedas, which are there in Srimad Bhagavatam, which are there in the Vedic literature, you know, how the words can really describe Brahman? And in fact, how is that possible? How you can reach this state of transcendence by reading the words of the scriptures? How they can even closely approach scriptures or the spiritual understanding, because this is material sounds, material meanings are there. We have our material mind, material intelligence, and we only have these material things, and we're listening on these material sounds. How the spiritual understanding, which is totally, completely, categorically different, can come through the studying of the Vedas? And this is the question which is being posed. That the Vedas are dealing with the normal sound and the normal things are being described by them, how you can understand spirit by this? And this is a very relevant question. And Shukadev Goswami, he gives a very interesting answer to this question, indirectly, which you cannot, again, understand directly. He says, well, he says, all of a sudden he starts saying something which is on the first reading seems to be totally indirected with the question. Parikshit Maharaj is asking very straightforward question. How Vedas can really, how the words of the Vedas can really give you understanding, even if you think so deeply about them, how this can give you any understanding of the spiritual processes within your heart? And Sukadev Goswami says, you know, the Lord, He created this world, and He created the objects of this world, and He created the senses. And He created the mind, and He created buddhi, intelligence. And, you know, how is that answer my question? Please tell me. All of a sudden, and sometimes we know in ISKCON also, you know, somebody asked the lecturer some very pertinent questions, and he starts answering about something totally different, which he just likes to say in this particular moment, and you wonder what's going on there. But in this case of question and answer of Maharaja Parikshit, it's not like this. He gives an answer, and he gives a very deep answer. What he says, and this is what we have to understand, and this is actually very directly related to this particular verse. He says, by this answer, that, you know, you are the spirit soul, and there is objects of this world, and God created this world, and he says, in his answer, he says, God created this world for the enjoyment of the spirit souls. How God created this world for the enjoyment of the spirit souls? What did He create for the enjoyment of the spirit souls? He created what? How the spirit soul, which is categorically different from the matter, can enjoy this world? How? Yeah. Ahankara. Ahankara is making him identify with the matter. And then the matter, the material mechanism, he creates the senses, which interact so beautifully and so romantically with the objects of the senses, you know. There's so much is going on, you know. The ear is hearing, the eye is seeing, the nose is smelling, and the tongue is tasting, and the skin is enjoying by the touch. All this is going on. and this is how you enjoy. This is the answer which Shukadev Goswami gives to this question, and the answer is very appropriate. He says, if the Lord would not create all these senses, the stupid spirit soul would not be able to enjoy matter. It's only Lord who facilitated his enjoyment, and he created all these beautiful mechanisms, including buddhi and including mind, for us to enjoy. So otherwise, the stupid conditioned soul would not be able to do this, because it would be deaf, blind, and completely, you know, would not be able to taste anything, that the spirit soul is given all these facilities by the Lord Himself. And in similar way, what he means to say by answering this question of Maharaja Pariksit, he means to say that in this similar way, even though now your buddhi intelligence is completely material and your mind is completely material, the Lord, through the sounds of the Vedas, through the words of the Vedas, can give you intelligence, transcendental intelligence, by which you can understand Brahman. So this is the answer which he gives. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, explaining this answer, he says how it's going on, how the process of understanding Brahman through the descriptions of the Vedas is taking place. He says that when a conditioned living entity who is a sadhaka, who developed little desire to understand the Lord, read the Vedas, for example, reads Gopaltapani Upanishad. Gopaltapani Upanishad is one of the Shrutis. And read the Shrutis, which are written in this Samadhi Bhasha, in this language of Samadhi, which is very difficult to understand. And in this Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he quotes the verse from Gopaltapani Upanishad, which describes Krishna. And in this verse it is said that Krishna, he has the his skin, his complexion is the color of the cloud, of rain cloud. And his dhoti is the color of the lightning. And he has vanamala, he has the garland of the forest flowers. And he is standing, as it is said in Gopaltapani Upanishad in this verse, in the posture of meditative silence, in this mauna mudra, dhyan, in the posture of meditative silence. And this is God. This is the description of God. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that when the sadhakas, when the devotee who has developed already the transcendental intelligence, the transcendental senses, when he reads this verse directly connects him with the direct perception of the transcendental Lord. And he sees the Lord, the image of the Lord appears within his transcendental intelligence, the transcendental image of the Lord. This verse serves as the connection with the Lord. And he immediately, by his transcendental intelligence, his whole appearance is there and he sees him. His meditation is totally there, and he is capable of perceiving this, all these attributes of the Lord, which is described in this verse. And he says, but when the conditioned living entity, like us, sadhakas, when they read this verse, they only hear material words, because they only have the material ear. They don't have the transcendental hearing sense. And they only have material intelligence. And by their material intelligence, they imagine something material. The material image of some kind appears in our dirty material intelligence. You know, Krishna is, you know, yeah, yellow, yes, yes. Yellow, something like this, and then blue, yeah, like this. And he's standing in the moon. And they think, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the sadhakas, they think that they meditate on the Lord, even though they don't meditate on the Lord, because this is not the Lord. This is just material image, which is created by their material intelligence through the means of material sounds. But, he says, the Lord is so merciful, and he's there within the heart, and he's there, and he thinks, pure. He's meditating upon me. That's very nice. And in this way, the Lord is pleased with someone, with our feeble attempts to understand him, to meditate upon him. Even though in the beginning it's not really meditation, because we cannot really even concentrate our mind. Our mind is so distracted, and we didn't really even approach the state of Brahman. That's specifically said there by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura. You cannot even attain this Brahman level of meditation. What to speak about meditating the Supreme Lord, who is transcendental even to Brahman level. But still, he says, when on the
stage, on the level of sadhana, you think about this, you read the scriptures, you try to imagine the Lord, and you try to, you know, think again and again deeply, then the Lord takes it literally. And the Lord says, yes, he's meditating on me. Very nice, very nice. Thank you very much. Such a nice devotee. He's trying to do this. And he is entering our mind through this imperfect process of material meditation. Through this imperfect process, however imperfect it is, still, the meaning here in this answer of Shukadev Goswami is that it is the Lord who can give you the facility to understand him. As much as the Lord gave you the facility to interact with this world, he gave you the senses to interact with this world and to enjoy this world. In a similar way, when we try to do this, when we hear about Lord Krishna and his pastimes, when we read the scriptures, when we think deeply about the scriptures, then by this means of imperfect material meditation, still the Lord is entering into our meditation, and he is ultimately, gradually purifying our senses and giving us the spiritual intelligence and giving us the facility to understand him. Basically, what is being also described here, that the bhakti yoga, even it is imperfect in the beginning stages of its development, still it can give you the facilities to conquer over the problems which are there. And it ultimately, if you strengthen your dependence on the Lord, it can give you the facility to see the Lord directly. We are dependent on the Lord from the very beginning. We are dependent on the Lord. We have to be dependent on the Lord from the very beginning stages, that it's only him who can give me the intelligence to conquer over all the problems which are there, all the anarthas. It's only him who can give me, and ultimately it's only him who can give me the deliverance or the transcendental understanding of who he really is, what it really means that Krishna is Shyam, that his color is Shyam, what it really means that his dhoti is yellow. It's not that simple. But for us, it's the beginning stage. It starts from this stage, because this is what we can, what we are capable to do. And then the Lord, by his mercy, gives us this facility, gives us this power, this capacity. And I don't want to speak about the last part of this, how the demons are being killed, because this is too long. I told this in Heidelberg. It's not that important. But there is a very interesting sequence in this purifying of our anarthas according to the you know, the order in which these six demons were killed by the Lord. But that you can think yourself if you want sometime. But the main thing is here that ultimately we have to think about the Vedas. We have to think about the words of Srimad Bhagavatam. We have to think very deeply about this meaning. And by this process, and the Lord, who is being pleased with our feeble attempts to do this, will give us the transcendental intelligence and will ultimately free us from all these problems of conditioned existence which are there. So that's I don't know if I bewildered everyone or what, but the main point is that we have to think. We really have to think. We should not take anything blindly. We have to learn how to think about Krishna again and again and again through each and every word in the scriptures and in Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's the simple message.
Thank you. These puppets, Vaishnava Chakravarti Thakur says that even a beginner's meditation, which is almost apt to have, you know, to associate the Lord with material,
destined, you know, it's there is no other way.
That is in the Sharada Darshini
commentary. It should be
the 87th chapter.
But still, there is this transcendental connection, and we can. The point is that we can and we should try to develop intelligence. That the Bhakti Yoga is the means to develop our transcendental intelligence, by which we ultimately can see the Lord face to face. This is the way and the progression of this verse. And by the way, we will conquer over all these problems and the intoxication of the material madness. Okay. If there is no questions, then we can.
No other questions? Yeah.
Thank you very much. I was thinking all the time because you were talking about so many things, so many thoughts, so many. Oh, it's hard to tell. No, good question in the essence. But I was thinking, I was asking question to my Guru Maharaj, Krishna Kshatra Prabhu, about. This buddhi or intelligence or approach Krishna through Bhagavad Gita, through knowledge, through buddhi intelligence. And on the other side, it is our movement, we are following Lord Chaitanya, it's bhakti, there are sentiments. And I am really finding sometimes it's hard time for me to connect this high knowledge from Bhagavad Gita with sentiments, bhakti, chanting Hare Krishna. You were talking yesterday about emerging into chanting constantly. I just wanted to ask you if it's approaching Krishna through knowledge, through buddhi, or through sentiments. As a pure feelings, it's connected to our being conditioned to, for example, only sentiments, feelings, or jnana, or on the other side being conditioned to jnana, or it is we should find balance.
Okay. Okay. Our sentiments should be purified by the means of intelligence. Ultimately, the highest method of approaching God is through the sentiments. And this is the teaching of Srimad Bhagavatam. But Srimad Bhagavatam is the postgraduate study, and Srila Prabhupada used to say that Bhagavad Gita is ABC, it's just ABC. It's the beginning stage. And in the beginning stage, you have to have knowledge, because knowledge is purifying. You have to develop the intelligence, because by the means of intelligence, you can purify your sentiments. Otherwise, our sentiments are very, not very pure. But ultimately, it's not the intelligence which is the highest means of approaching God. It's the sentiments. Sentiments are much higher. Intelligence is just a preliminary stage of our understanding, and it has to be there. It's explained by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that the knowledge of the Vedas means to understand yukti, or the logic of the scriptures. In other words, and if the understanding of the logic of the scriptures is very strong, then your faith becomes also very strong. Shraddha, in the beginning, the Shraddha is Komala Shraddha. Komala means pliable, means very flexible, means, you know, it's just, you push it and it's completely different shape now. You read something, few words of some materialist in some book, scholarly book about Srimad Bhagavatam, and your perception is totally changed. So therefore, what Rupa Goswami says that in the beginning, and when he is explaining this knowledge and Shraddha, he is explaining Dadikar for Vaidhi Sadhana, for the beginning stages of the sadhana. And the beginning stages of the sadhana, you need to have very strong faith, and the strong faith is coming from the systematic logical knowledge of the scriptures. The knowledge of the scriptures is the backbone of Shraddha. If you have structured, systematic knowledge of the scriptures, then your Shraddha will become Dridha Shraddha. In the beginning it's Komala Shraddha. Komala means pliable or flexible or tender. Like sometimes Srimati Radharani is called Komala. Komala means very tender. So our Shraddha is also very tender, very feeble. But then it has to become Dridha. Dridha means very hard, very strong and hard, so that nobody can shake. And this is coming through the knowledge. This is coming through Shastra Yukti, through the logical understanding, because it gives you the very structured foundation for everything. You know, nobody can shake your faith if you have this logic understanding of the Vedas. But then, this is again only the foundation for our purified sentiments, because ultimately it's the only qualification for Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti. And we know that we are supposed to develop Raga, and Raga means attachment, Raga means emotions. Raga, which is based on the greed, you know, through these things, thinking about Vedic literature, you develop greed. You know, ultimately you will develop very strong desire. I want to understand who is this Krishna, you know, after all. so much I have heard about him. Who is he? And this is emotional attachment. But these emotions, they can be very strong and pure, not whimsical. When your knowledge is also strong and pure, so it has to be combined in a certain sequence. Okay, thank you very much.